This is the best album ever, a part of the Overthink Podcast Network. I'm your host, Ben Helms, and today we continue our journey together in search of the best album ever. Each episode will be joined by a different guest whose musical opinion I hold in high esteem, who will present an album on the podcast in an attempt to convince me that this album is truly and definitively the greatest album in the history of recorded works. We'll dig into the track list together, we'll analyze the lyrics, dissect the melodies, and of course we'll come up with a few theories tying the entire thing together, making it that much greater. So over the course of the entire podcast, we'll have a lot of contenders, both albums you've heard that are in Spin and Rolling Stone's top 100 albums ever, and albums and bands that you probably, kind of like me, never even heard of. So it's my hope that through this show, we'll finally settle this once and for all and eventually wind up with a consensus pick of the best album ever. On today's episode of Best Album Ever, we're joined by a professional musician, singer-songwriter living in Southern California now, a guy I've known for many, many years, Mr. Andrew Capra. Thank you so much for aiding me in my journey.
I'm so happy to talk about music. You have no idea.
Yeah, both of us do this. We talk about music a lot. I mix stuff for a living. You make music for a living. So yeah, we're definitely excited to take breaks from our day jobs and do more music things. So that'll be good. So yeah, a little intro into kind of our relationship. We've known each other for a long time. We have kind of a unique musical relationship. I'm kind of your musical Padawan, and you're my musical master for most of our adolescence, at least.
I don't know if I put it that way, but you did play drums for my high school band at least once.
Oh gosh, I blocked most of that out of my memory. That was a rough night for me.
Oh man, I just think it's worth noting on the record, or at least your listeners should know that you played an ice skating rink show with me. We had to be 15, 16, and we were freezing, and we played an hour and a half. It was great.
That was so weird. What a weird show. But yeah, that was awesome. That was fun, man.
Yeah.
All I remember from that night is all the mistakes I made, though, unfortunately. Well, yeah, so we've known each other a long time. You used to be in a band called Halfway to Nowhere, and which was one of the big Bay Area bands that we followed in high school. And so me, all of our mutual friends went, you know, that was kind of what we did every Friday and Saturday night. We went to the Halfway show. You played in the Halfway show. After every gig, we went to Denny's afterwards till 2 or 3 in the morning. I don't know why or how our parents let us do that, but that's what happened.
Yeah, seriously.
Then I remember when I bought Pro Tools, the music recording software, junior, senior year of high school, I invited you over and I begged you to come over. You came over and kind of showed me the ropes for a few hours, helped me record my first few tracks, and just kind of held my hand through that entire process, which ended up kind of starting one of my biggest passions in life since then, and my eventual career. It's what I do now. And yeah, so hey, thanks for that, by the way.
Happy to be a part, man.
Yeah.
We've all added to each other's lives.
Oh, very true. Very true. So since then, I followed you through bands Hopefield, Brave Citizens, and now your recent solo stuff released under the name Andrew London.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to that later as far as how people can listen to you and find you. But I definitely made a few connections from this album that you picked to kind of your solo stuff, even some Hopefield stuff. I was trying to make connections between why you would pick this and why, you know, how it's influenced your music that you've made.
Mm-hmm.
But I was still pretty surprised at the album. I don't think I would have picked this. It would have taken a while for me to pick this as far as your choice for best album ever. But you want to talk about what this pick is and kind of how you wound up picking it?
Yeah, so my nominee for best album ever for this podcast is Peter Gabriel's solo album, So.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of those records that I think defines a time and a space, and for me, it checks all the boxes for what I consider qualifiers for a classic or great album.
Mm.
Everyone's got to say something different, but I think for this one, if I had to make a list of criteria that all those should abide by, this one would pretty much hit every box.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you definitely say of the time. I'm glad you said that, because when I think of best album ever, I think the first thing I go to is timeless. And I think in listening to this, it's definitely timeless in the sense that these are well-written songs still, but there's definitely a lot of 1986 and that time mm-hmm. kind of echoing in this album. So it's a good point that you say that one of your criteria was something that, or what you just said, which was basically it defined a time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this definitely does that.
I think timeless is overrated. I think it's overused and overrated.
Fair enough. All right.
I mean, you can say that a song at its core is written to stand the test of time, and that's true. I mean, you can look at a Bob Dylan song or something like that and say that's a timeless song.
Yeah.
But what I think makes an album classic for me, or one of the best ever, is that it really just takes a moment and puts it in the capsule and keeps it there.
Yeah.
And you can go back to it. And so for this record, I mean, you have to look at the time. You have to look at the musical landscape at the time. Who are the players on the scene? You've got Prince winning Grammys that year. Mm-hmm. You've got the Joshua Tree. You've got Paul Simon won Album of the Year for Graceland that year. You got these people that are pushing the envelope. It was a time of like musical experimentation. Mm-hmm. Then you've got all the social commentary of the 80s, and he's a big figure for that. And so I think I would take that any day over songs that sound like, oh, well, that song could have been in the 60s or it could have been now, you know?
Yeah, and he definitely was very into kind of what was going on then at the time as far as people's struggles around the world. He did a lot of charity, and I think he played, was it Live Aid with Bono, and just kind of played all over the world at these different free charitable things. And there's a lot of that, and those themes echoed throughout the album as well.
Right.
So yeah, what were, I guess, any other criteria that you went through that, and maybe talk about a couple albums that didn't quite make the list when you were putting your criteria together?
Sure. So I think some of the other albums I was looking at, like one of my favorite records is Bookends by Simon and Garfunkel, which I loved, and that's got, you know, hits front to back. And
yeah.
I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about a couple other records, like, U2, Achtung Baby or something like that, or War.
Not Joshua Tree.
I mean, I love Joshua Tree, but I go back to, like, the experimentation and musical boundaries. I don't know, the Joshua Tree is good, too, but...
that's definitely an album with every song is a hit, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, all those records are 10 out of 10s. It's just a matter of, like, which 10 you're going to pick.
Sure.
But I thought that this record was kind of more unique in the sense that there was so much experimentation going on, and this record was such a homegrown record that Peter Gabriel had like retreated and done this record at home and brought in a group of people and recorded music around the world that inspired him and kind of put this record together. And he's such a quirky guy, and like he was insistent on the way it needed to be done and not be done.
Yeah.
And he was even pissed to call it so. His record label told him that. And so that for me is all part of the album experience.
Yeah, this is definitely very eye-opening for me, which is a byproduct of doing this podcast. I love just learning about these different artists. But Peter Gabriel to me was just kind of random, cheesy 80s artist. I didn't really know much about him. So just diving in, even just his Wikipedia page, but all these different articles I tried to read in prepping for this, it was fascinating to find out how much he cared about his music, which sounds dumb because it's his life, but it's interesting finding out just why these artists care about certain parts of the music that I never thought about, which was like the naming of the album. I didn't realize his first four or five albums didn't have names.
Yeah.
And why? And it's, again, because he didn't like that. He has a lot of reasons why, but he has one of the reasons was it distracts from the sleeve design, which I love that. Just any text would distract the eye from visually just seeing a picture of him or a picture of a car, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But yeah, him fighting with the label for the name of it, you know, even naming it So was a struggle. And even the name So, a two-letter name, was kind of his way of rebelling and being like, nah, I'm not really going to give it a name.
Yeah, and for me, that's the consummate artist, like someone that cares about, I really don't want a name distracting from my album sleeve. How rad is that? Like, how many artists really think like that? And, you know, Peter Gabriel does get lumped in because of the, you know, songs like In Your Eyes, where it was just a part of the zeitgeist and in movies, and you just think of, you know, classic scenes that you would think of holding radios over your head. But his roots are so prog rock and so weird that if you look up old Genesis videos and he's like has crazy stage makeup and is doing this kind of jester thing, and these songs are super prog art rock, and kind of the way that he's gone from that and kind of laced it into his solo work is so unique.
Yeah. Yeah. So I listened to the, my process for this was listen to the album 2 or 3 times, then kind of dive into the lyrics and do some research into why he wrote these, how he wrote these, who he wrote them with, you know, read some of the reviews. And I was really surprised to, and this is my lack of knowledge of Peter Gabriel, really surprised that this was listed as his most accessible. I knew it was, I'd heard of the album. I knew it was a big commercial success, but I didn't realize it was the album. Like, it's the one that stands out above. It's his highest selling, you know, it's 5-time platinum in the US, 3-time platinum in the UK, like huge selling. It was ranked, not that this matters on our show, but it was ranked 187 in Rolling Stone's top 500 greatest albums of all time. So pretty high on the list. Yeah, so this was definitely his kind of commercial pop success, which again was surprising after listening to the album. It has songs like, which I'll play a couple clips right here, Sledgehammer. Songs like In Your Eyes, and I think of Big Time, and then like those are the big like poppy songs that are like funky beats, big bass lines, big drums, but most of the album is not that. Most of the album is Red Rain, Don't Give Up, Mercy Street, and songs that are slower with like droning synths, and you have like 16th note hi-hats in the background with big gated snares whenever they do come in. But yeah, it's very kind of ethereal, most of the album, and experimental might be the right word, that a lot of it harkens back to kind of his older stuff.
I think it's a great convergence of when artists are really experimental, and then they go through the process of refining their songwriting craft over the years.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is just another qualifier for a great album of all time. It's just this convergence of they're at their peak of experimentation and their peak of songwriting. And together it's this, you know, this chemistry.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's start diving into kind of the track list. What is your maybe example of either the best song or your favorite song on the album?
Oof. I would say my favorite on the record is probably Red Rain.
Yeah, the lead-off track, number one, which, by the way, again, another note of how strange it is that this is his most commercial album is almost every song is over 5 minutes long.
Yeah.
So it's another kind of experimental, like, I'm going to do my own thing no matter what the record company wants me to do. But why Red Rain is your choice for favorite song?
It's just one of those songs where I think it takes you, it's a musical landscape for me. Like, when I think of, when songs take me to a place where I can imagine a place, that's for me the ultimate moment. And so for this one, I just have the visuals of just driving through the desert and seeing huge mountains in a pass, and it just grabs you right from the top. It starts out with the drums, and you go on this kind of journey. And I think that one's got Stuart Copeland from The Police on drums.
Oh yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, I think that's him playing the top part of it, playing the hi-hat. But that's awesome. it just kind of takes you and you're in his psyche, and it's really sets the tone for the entire work. Like, we're going on this journey. Welcome. Here we go.
Yeah.
And that's dive in.
Yeah, that's true. It is a good kind of example of all of the kind of longer droning melodic parts, but it also has the big gated reverb drums that are huge and the hi-hat going, which, Stuart Copeland's the king of the hi-hat. Exactly. But yeah, that's a good call. I didn't even think of Red Rain as being that. When I read the research into Red Rain, it was talking about how this was based on a dream that Peter Gabriel had. It was talking about how it was a soundtrack for a movie that ended up never being made, but it was literally talking about Red Rain. Like pouring down as like blood was coming down from the heavens. I was like, oh, wow. It's good imagery. Go. It's very literal in that sense. But yeah, I mean, the mood of the song is definitely very driving. Reminded me of very much of like a road trip, like you were saying.
Yeah.
So if this is your favorite song, do you have a separate song that is maybe a song that sums up the album or is the best song on the album?
Yeah, I think Mercy Street is probably that for me. Mercy Street is, to me, a masterwork. It's just a commanding vocal performance.
Mm-hmm.
It's so minimal. It's one of his grooves that he's kind of laying over, and there's very minimal parts, but they all have such a profound impact. Every time that Tony Levin plays a bass slide,
oh man,
you go, oh, whoa. And it's just it's another one of those songs where you feel like you're just kind of taken on a journey, and I can't get enough of that song. When I saw it live, I'm pretty sure I cried.
Nice. You saw this album, he played the entire album straight through?
Yeah, he played So on a tour.
Wow.
A few years back, he came and did like an anniversary tour.
That's awesome.
And so he played his hits and then he settled in and he played this front to back.
Wow.
at the Hollywood Bowl.
That would be an epic experience. Yeah, again, like you said, because there are so many different instruments on this thing. There's a flute solo in Mercy Street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm not even sure if it real? Is it a synth?
Right.
I don't
know. I know. That's what I was asking myself in every song. Wait, is this a real organ? Or is this just his, like, 46-key little, like, synth that he's using on everything? I don't know what's happening.
Yeah, and that's the other part of it, too, is, like, that Fairlight. That is the sound, kind of the sound of this record was such a unicorn at the time that it came out. Mm. I mean, he was probably one of the only people that could afford one.
Oh, wow.
Because they were so prohibitively expensive at that time. But it sets the tone for the record. And it is the most rudimentary of rudimentary. If you ever look at like what the Fairlight screen used to look like and how you would load in samples.
That's why it has like a little like computer monitor on top of it, right, where you can see the frequencies and you can... What else do you use the monitor for with the Fairlight?
I think you can go through some patches that way, and okay. I think it's got an ability to sample, too, and so or you can, like, pick out parts of its input, but sure. there's an iPhone, iPad synth.
Yes.
Someone made a Fairlight app, and it's, just to see how rudimentary it is.
Oh,
but,
my gosh.
That's and awesome. To think of someone like spending hours and hours trying to get a sound and then trying to work on a track and being like, it's not quite right. And spending hours on it is just another example, I think, of what makes albums worth diving into is people trying to find new sounds.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. And that's one of the biggest differences between making music today and making music even 15, 20, obviously 30, 40, 50 years ago, where you would spend that much time getting a sound back then and getting the perfect sound. You'd have to recut the tape or use brand new tape to get it again. And now there's way more music being made, which means there is an argument to be said that, you know, there's better music being made. But I would also make the argument that there's a lot of really bad. There's way more bad music being made today than there ever was before because anyone can make music. I can make music, you know? So you still have to dig through it just as much to find good stuff. And I think one of the challenges of looking at older music, even 1986, so in our lifetimes, in my lifetime at least. Were you born when this album was made?
86? Was I? Oh, yeah. I think I was.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I was born in 86, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of the challenges for me in looking at these albums that are from this age or you know, from an age that everything in my lifetime has basically been based on this album and albums that came before it, is finding out what these sounds, specifically the synth sounds, some of the stuff he's doing with his vocals as well, but is this stuff derivative from previous 80s and 70s albums, or am I just thinking that because there was so much stuff influenced by this album? But yeah, it's definitely my challenge in going through this is finding out what this was influenced by and what this influenced, and kind of trying to separate those as much as I can in the research.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a subset of 80s. I mean, it has a lot of the hallmark parts of 80s records. Yeah. And I think it just is unavoidable by being recorded in that time. But then it's also part of a little subsect of kind of world music enthusiasts.
Sure.
That were happening at the time. Enthusiast is probably an understatement, but yeah, you've got, you know, Paul Simon and Peter Gabriel were not the only people making kind of art, rock, world music inspired records. It was definitely a time for exploring that. They just mastered it, but
yeah,
but it's all part of it.
Yeah, definitely. So we talked about kind of the musical kind of landscape at the time. We talked about the flute solos, the synth. One of the things that stood out to me at first, I think it was in, what was it, Sledgehammer, where you just get that crazy funky, the horns at the beginning and the bass line. There's half of these songs have these incredible bass lines that are just big and loud and in your face, which is always my issue when I'm mixing bass lines. The first instinct is like, oh, turn up the bass frequency, which is not necessarily what you want to do, because then you don't really hear bass. You just kind of hear droning notes. So the amount of treble in the bass lines was inspirational, honestly, and as far as my mixing, because you hear all the treble of the bass, but it's not like ear-piercingly loud. You don't hear the strings kind of cutting through, but you hear them cutting through the mix in a good way. You hear what he's playing, exactly what he's playing, but you still hear and feel the bass of that driving the song, which is really hard to do. But it was a group of musicians, right? It wasn't just one band, or was it just a group of guys recording this album?
As far as I know there were a couple standby, a couple guys that were a part of almost all the record. And I know that there's a wide cast of characters though that came in, but I'm pretty sure that, I mean, Tony Levin's the bass player on it. And Manu Katché, I think his name is, played drums on most of the record.
Okay.
But yeah, they were a part of defining it. And Tony Levin's got a really, mid-rangey bass sound that kind of sits, man, and it kind of growls. And
totally.
And they left a lot of space for it.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely cuts through, especially with the amount of synth and just and guitars and all the other instruments in almost every song that are just piled up. That bass cuts through like no other. And then obviously you have Kate Bush singing on Don't Give Up, too, which is just kind of another classic ballad. But yeah, I love that song where it, to me, by the second chorus is kind of getting, frustrated. I was getting frustrated in the song where it was like verse, chorus, and then you have this really light piano breaking in right at the end of that second chorus, which is, again, this kind of like light at the end of the tunnel point of the song, Don't Give Up. And she's singing to him, Don't Give Up. And he's singing constantly, like, these are all the reasons I want to give up. And she's even saying, like, you still have us at the very end. So it's just a glimmer of hope. Don't give up. But yeah, I think that might be my favorite song on the album, just the kind of back and forth they have throughout the song, which could be seen as cheesy when I first heard a voice coming in, but it won me over by the end of the song for sure. And I mean, rare for me to like a song that doesn't really have any drums throughout. I think it's basically just kind of a hi-hat kind of ticking in the background and the occasional drum, bass drum, floor tom kind of hits throughout. But as soon as that piano came in, it was just like, yep, this is my song.
It's such a heartbreaker. I mean,
it is, and
I definitely am quick to write off duets or anything sort of like that, or I think, oh man, that sounds so cheesy or dated or what have you. But that one, I mean, you've got Kate Bush, like, oh my God, and then you've got Peter Gabriel, but then you've also got this heartbreaking song that's kind of a Margaret Thatcher era song where you've got a ton of people unemployed, and I think that's that probably just resonated across the UK at that point.
And we didn't even get into the fact that this was the first song that I texted you about when listening to the album. And I was just like, what's the meter of this song? And I had to Google it just to be like, this is 3/4, because it starts in 3/4. And then they start singing in like 4/4, 6/8. Like, they start singing in these weird parts. And I sat down today and like tapped on my desk for the entire song. The whole thing's in 3/4, from what I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
But they're singing and the piano and just... They're not playing this traditional 3/4 sing-songy swinging beat throughout. And it's, again, it goes to, for me, it ties in the theme of the song, which is his kind of confused instability and kind of hardships of the situation that he's singing about. And then she comes in and towards the end starts singing more and more on beat throughout the song. and kind of saying, hey, don't give up. And mm-hmm. here's some stability for you in my singing. But yeah, that to me is another reason why anything that plays with meter has already won my heart.
Yeah. There's just a constant motion in the background. Yeah. And to me, this might be like just me reaching here, but I always feel like it's kind of the world around them or just everything that continues to keep going. And
they're not quite keeping up as they sing.
Yeah. He's just kind of at the end of his rope and yeah. they're just kind of on this train track and they're together in it.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of the moment. And that's the beauty in using such little instrumentation to me.
Yep. Definitely. I think the order of the album is fascinating because this comes right after. So it goes Red Rain and then two songs later, Don't Give Up. They're very similar and they're kind of slower, melodic, anxious maybe. But and then right in between you have Sledgehammer, which was one of the three or four singles off the album in the U.S. at least. And it's this big, funky, like big horns, ridiculous, like sexual innuendos throughout.
Mm-hmm.
At times it reminded me of Business Time from Flight of the Conchords.
Uh-huh.
It's just like, and then I looked into it because I used genius.com, which has a lot of annotations on the lyrics. And I think there was just one person commenting on the lyrics because I was like, every single line is about sex. I like, really? And then I looked into it more and more. And Gabriel's quote about it was, sometimes sex can break through barriers when other forms of communication are not working too well. That was his quote about Sledgehammer. I was like, all right, fair enough.
I love it. It's just an artist writing about what he wants to write about, you know. I think the sequencing of this record is also part of what makes it so masterful to me, because you're looking at it as it would sit on an LP.
Yeah.
And you've got Red Rain and you got that voice again. And the way that ends is the end of side one. Side two, you start off, boom, In Your Eyes.
Yeah.
And then you're taking it out with, you know, We Do What We're Told. This is the picture. We're kind of getting more ethereal.
Yep. Yeah, I definitely did not know what Milgram's 37 was. I definitely had to search that. That's kind of the parenthetical statement on We Do What We're Told,
mm-hmm.
which was the song that as soon as I heard it, I was like, oh, this is Dark Side of the Moon, which is one of my favorite albums. It's obviously one of the highest selling albums of all time. But as soon as I heard it, I was like, this sounds so much like Money.
Mm-hmm.
And it has even like the crazy reverb on the distorted guitars in the background. It has like the underwater drums, which Gabriel said sounded like it was supposed to imitate a heartbeat heard from a womb.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very specific.
Yeah.
It refers to, I guess, I did some research into Milgram's 37. It was a psychological test, where people would shock other people and you'd hear screaming in the background. And you ask the person if they still want to keep shocking. And they'd be like, mm-hmm. what's going on? What's that person yelling? They'd be like, oh, don't worry about it. Just keep pressing the shock button or something to that. That's not the exact test, but something to that effect. So he's talking about the 37%, and that represents the people that wouldn't continue pressing the button. So it's kind of the people rebelling. Again, going into Peter Gabriel's kind of rebellious stage or rebellious life, I guess. Which actually, by the way, the actual percentage was 35%. So I just wanted to correct that here. Everyone go to your So album, take out your Sharpie. Correct the percentage. But yeah, he talks about how it kind of seems like a negative thing throughout the song. It's kind of a negative. All of the lyrics focus on the kind of the negative, but he was trying to focus on the positive. The 37% that didn't press the button, that are kind of rebelling and standing up for the marginalized, the person that couldn't stand up for themselves, you know?
Yeah, I think it's a great statement on, I think like a obedience to power.
Exactly. Totally. Yeah. And then it ends with, this is kind of a weird ending because it has nine tracks that I could see. It ends with This Is the Picture, which has this like talk singing, like here it comes, watch it fall. I can hear them now, which was definitely a very, I want to say whatever the opposite of timeless in the sense that not like this is very 1986, but it's very much not a 2017 thing, not a lyric music that I listen to, which is like talk singing. Definitely stood out to me. But I'd be interested to get your take on why This Is the Picture is still a song that to you could be on one of the best albums ever, where it has that kind of experimental talking going on.
Yeah, I think it's him kind of putting his signature on it.
Sure.
I think it's him signing his name at the end of the letter to us. It's kind of like his little wink and his thing. Like, I am in control of all of this. And and this is, you know, this is what I want to convey front to back. And so, you know, regardless of musicians or producer or record label or what have you, is just, this is my musical journey, and this is how I want to have you out. I mean, this is the picture, or we do what we're told. They're not songs that I just throw on when I want to just listen casually to Peter Gabriel tracks. But I love that it's more than that. It's part of the ending. And I think even either the last track or the second to last track was added like the day before he submitted it.
Oh, geez. It is interesting. You know, I grew up with listening to albums that like the first track is the single, or, you know, you hear like Poppy Hit and then like a couple experimental and then Poppy Hit and then a couple experimental. And, you know, you see these songwriters trying to break up the album in ways that will, you know, they'll lose the listener and then it'll bring them back, and they'll lose the listener and bring them back. And it's refreshing to see someone just kind of be like, here are my 9 songs. Like, take them or leave them. I'm going to do them my way. I'm not going to do them the way the record company wants me to do it.
Yeah.
I might have a couple poppy tracks that I didn't really like. I'm not going to put them on the album. So that was interesting. Actually, they re-released this album a couple years ago, and they put 2 more songs on it. One is called Courage, which is like a very poppy, industrial feeling, kind of kinetic song.
Mm-hmm.
And another one called Sagrada, which, by the way, I could not find on the internet.
Really?
It exists somewhere in a box set. Huh. It's called Sagrada, and I couldn't find it. But yeah, again, those weren't released on the original version anyway. So, but yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I love how concise this record is.
Yeah.
And he included just what he wanted. And it's not that it's over. He wasn't over editing. It's not like he was just, well, these are the only things. And, you know, he also kept some of these songs were first takes from the musicians, and he wanted it that way.
That's
and
cool.
So it's a matter of control. Like,
yep,
it's a artistic vision. So there's just so few artistic visions like this. That's why this has got to be one of the best records of all time.
Man, that's awesome. I love that. And obviously, we want people to go out and maybe, you know, sit down, find your best headphones, your best speakers, and listen to this album. It's 45 minutes. You know, so it's an episode of your favorite television show, maybe Game of Thrones or whatever. And yeah, listen to this. Maybe sit down with the lyrics and kind of absorb it. We'd love to hear what you know listeners think of this album. Whether they love it, hate it, whatever it is, we'd love to hear about it. Any final notes on kind of the album as a whole that you have?
You know, I think that, and a lot of people say this with records, but I think this is one that's listened to in order. I think it's a great way to go.
Okay.
You're not going to be able to find it on Spotify. Peter Gabriel's a little late to the technology or streaming game. And so, you know, but you can find it on YouTube, and I've definitely purchased it on iTunes so I can listen on demand. But listen to the record in order and hear the sequencing and just hear people holed up in a house for a long time, sitting there creating and taking snippets of things that they recorded in other countries, and taking little snippets of words that make no sense and making them into these incredibly beautiful pieces of music.
Yeah, definitely. And I would actually go against when you say he's late to the party, in the sense that his website, petergabriel.com, is one of the best artists or musician websites I've ever seen. And I would use that rather than genius.com or Wikipedia or whatever, in the sense that he has a separate page per song of every song he's ever released.
Whoa.
And it has just like a little paragraph of like, hey, this is what album it came on, this is when it was released. And then it has a bunch of quotes from him, people that helped him write, you know, record the song or write the song. Every album. So that was very helpful, very insightful.
Wow.
Obviously, he controls the narrative that way. But still, very, very informative, I thought. So
yeah.
It'd be interesting to find out why he's not on Spotify, because that was my first frustration as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It must be a record label thing with
him. Yeah,
I think he might own part of his masters, too, and I think he opted not to be a part of that. Him and Bob Seger, you know, people like
that. Yeah, which, again, goes back to kind of him naming the album So, and this being the first album with a name that he has. Classic Peter Gabriel. But yeah, I'm definitely interested to kind of, now that I know not only who he is, but like some of the music that he's written, I'll definitely go back and listen to his first four or five albums before this and all the stuff since then to kind of see if there's anything that I like as well as this stuff. Any other musical suggestions if people are into this or other stuff that you're into that you might want to point people to besides just this album?
Yeah, I would say I'd say this is a great starting place to get into Peter Gabriel or just to go, huh, what is his stuff like? And then I would kind of move forward and backward from there.
Sure.
His two solo records before this, you've got Salisbury Hill and you've got some of his first tracks that are kind of a part of the musical vocabulary of the time. And then moving forward, you'll see some of his most experimental stuff. He did the soundtrack for Passion of the Christ, I think, at the time.
Oh, wow.
It was called Passion of Christ. Okay. Martin Scorsese. I think it was Scorsese's like Last Temptation of Christ or something that.
Yeah.
Sorry, not Passion of the Christ.
Interesting. Him and Mel Gibson working together.
Yeah. But that's a trip. It's more like, definitely more ambient and experimental, but it's really interesting to see that he's a consummate artist, like from front to back. He can put out a song like In Your Eyes and he can make soundtrack music and it still feels like him. There's a great record. I think his 90 or 91 record, I forget what it's called, like Us or something like that. There's a song called Come Talk to Me that's one of my favorite songs. It's about him and his daughter. So I would just, use as your starting point and go to the sides.
Yeah. Whenever I write like a song that I know isn't going to be a pop hit, which is most of my songs, there's a part of me that's like, oh, if I could write the pop hit and then do the experimental stuff, then it'd be like, oh, this guy has credibility. And so his experimental stuff is that much more important, which is exactly what Peter Gabriel has been doing. He writes the experimental stuff and he was this cult hit or kind of fan favorite, I guess. And the fact that he can also write pop hits elevates his experimental stuff that much more. The fact that he's doing it with kind of a musical, not mindset, a pedigree and an awareness of what he's doing, both experimental and poppy.
Absolutely. It's someone that can paint with form and then paint out of form. I think it's amazing. Yeah,
definitely. All right, man. I think that's all the stuff I got on So. So is there anything? Can't help but say So after that. So where can people find you? Kind of what are some projects you're working on right now? Maybe the people can follow.
Sure. So I think one of the ways you can check out if you want to hear some more music is I've got a solo project that goes under the name Andrew London, and it's just kind of a catch-all for tunes. And so I'm putting out a new single, I think, next month, and I'll kind of be doing a steady stream of singles from here on out.
Nice.
I think that's a good way to do that. And then to hear some of my professional work as a songwriter and session musician, you can just go to myname.com, which is andrewcapra.com, and we can chat about more favorite records of all time.
Sweet. So you are releasing singles every couple months. Is there a hope to eventually, or maybe not a hope, a plan to eventually put all those together in a 9 to 12 track album that you will meticulously order?
I think I'm actually intentionally avoiding it this time.
All right.
I think it's just because, the last 10, 15 years of being in bands since I was a wee little guy, I've just put together albums and sequenced albums. And I think in the way that we enjoy music now and the way that music is made now, I thought that this would, I'm doing it selfishly to
sure.
kind of free me. And it's been nice instead of having to do 10 tracks worth of songs and figuring them out and put them together as a work to be able to work on little things that I want to work on. Oh, I love that song. I'm going to record it right now and then get that out and move on to the next thing. So I'm just trying a phase of doing singles.
It's funny because I hear that negatively of the whole, like, get off my lawn, these damn kids, of like, it's just singles these days, singles and EPs, and I want to hear a full album, and what happened to Pink Floyd putting together these 13 perfectly spaced songs that all lead into each other, that all mean something when they're put next to each other. But I've never thought of it as being kind of a boost and encouragement to a songwriter.
In sure.
The sense that, you just write a song, get it out there as soon as you can, rather than write the song, wait a year and a half until you have all the other songs mixed and mastered for the fans to hear. So it's good for the fans in that way too.
Yeah, I think it frees everyone up, and people gloss over the fact that singles were the driving force. I mean, from the Beatles, that's the way they were first consumed.
Yep.
And in the 80s, you've got bands that lived on the 7-inch single. So I don't think it's too unique. It's just a way that we enjoy music.
Yeah, just kind of circling back again to how music was 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Sure, yeah.
Awesome, man. I think that's all I have for you. Thanks again for joining me on Best Album Ever.
Thank you for having me. This has been so fun.
Awesome.
No pun intended.
Thanks again for joining us on Best Album Ever. Thanks again to Andrew for joining me. It was great talking music again with you and talking about So, an album that I'd only heard a couple tracks off of. So it was fun diving into that. And it's definitely on the shortlist. It's one of two albums right now from the podcast that are on the shortlist of Best Album Ever. So looking forward to next month and having another contender in the ring and talking about another album. So stay tuned to the Overthink Podcast Network, this feed you're listening to right now probably, for more great content on music, media, and culture. We have new shows coming out all the time, so look forward to that. You can find us over at overthinkpod.com and at Twitter and Instagram. We're at overthinkpod. You can email any questions, maybe any suggestions you have for what your favorite or what you think the best album ever is. We'll read it on there. It's overthinkpod@gmail.com. And I think that's all I have for you. Thanks again for joining me. See you next month.